Good afternoon. So last time, we went through a bunch of ways to approximate least recently used for the purpose of keeping stuff in memory that programs were using, parts of files, or their heap and stack data, and so on, which we all learned was part of the page cache earlier. So we talked about a bunch of policies for doing this. So one we started with the second chance idea, where we'd have this ordered list of pages, and we use the page that was on the list the longest, but only if it wasn't referenced any of the time it was on the list. If it was, instead we clear its reference bit, we'd mark it as not referenced anymore, put it at the top of the list, and give it a chance to prove that it really doesn't have any references for a while before we actually use it. So this policy means that anything we use made it all the way from the top to the bottom of the list without being referenced, and therefore wasn't used recently in some sense, and gives us, the result of approximating that least recently used without actually tracking every single access. We're only just checking, was it ever used once while it was on the list? Which is a lot cheaper. But that's maybe still a little too intensive because we're like checking for accesses over all our pages a lot, for one access. And maybe we want to be a little more precise about, only scanning things we think are going to be pretty inactive for accesses. So that gives us the seek policy, where we divide memory into active pages and inactive pages. And inactive pages are ones where we've made this guess that probably it's not being used. And we confirm that guess by looking to see if it's actually referenced. And when it is, we immediately, well, as soon as we notice at least, move it over to the active list at the beginning. And we fill the inactive list by taking things which we have kept on the active list for the longest amount of time without checking to see, well, is this still being used? We've had it for a while. Maybe it hasn't. So this is the idea that we sort of guess that things that haven't been used for a while, that we haven't checked for a while might be unused. We double check that they're really not being used right now over some period of time. That depends on the size of the inactive list, which is parameter we choose. And this means that we're not checking for every page being referenced all the time. We don't have to wait for something to make it all the way to the bottom of, all the way through the list twice if it was referenced to discover that it's not being used. We have this shorter period of time we're checking. And so it might be a better approximation of least recently used, and it avoids scanning all our pages for reference bits to do typical memory allocations, which we saw with second chance. That sort of thing happened where, pages, since they had to go through the list effectively twice, we have to do a lot of work to find a page to allocate relative to this. And we mentioned that there's this generalization of this idea that we're just going to periodically look at whether things are referenced, known as clock algorithms, where you just scan through all pages over time. And I was vague about, when do we scan, how often do we scan, and so on, because there's a wide variety of choices you can make here. Like, do you scan only when you need new pages? Do you check this periodically? But the idea is you check if something is referenced and you clear the information about whether it was referenced. So you get this history of during this set of time it was referenced, during this previous set of time it was referenced. And you can use that history in a whole wide variety of ways to approximate the least recently used policy. Deciding how are you going to break ties, if they were both referenced recently and they're referenced before, is that more important maybe? But this gives you the ability to do sort of a lot of least recently used approximations where you make decisions based on just knowing when accesses actually happened to some degree of precision. The degree depends on how aggressively you scan for accesses. And we also talked about things beyond least recently used. So this was being more proactive than our least recently used examples, which all of those were kind of based on when I need to allocate memory, I'm going to take something that's least recently used, and that's the only time at which I'm going to allocate memory. That's the simplest policy, but we can do better than that. And there are a bunch of ways we talked about doing better than that. So one was read ahead. That sometimes we can guess what you're going to access. We can see, oh, you're accessing the beginning of the file. You're probably going to access the middle of the file. So that's a sort of guess we can make, and we can read that before you actually access that memory, and therefore not have you wait when you have that page fault or read system call to access that memory. We also mentioned you could write back early. So our policy, you know, as written, was saying, well, we just keep it in memory until we need to evict it, but that means that if we lose power or disk is out of date, and it also means that allocating a page is going to take longer because we need to write back the old version. So we can just do that early and, you know, make sure it's done by the time we actually might care about the data in the page. And similarly, for allocating a page, we have to do this work of figuring out what page to allocate. We could just do that in advance, assuming, well, this program's running, it's probably going to need more memory. We can just evict some pages in advance, maybe a small number, just so when the program actually needs memory, we don't delay it then. And these policies are all great things to do when we assume we have some idle time. Either we aren't using all of our CPU all the time, so we might as well use a little bit of CPU earlier, so when I actually like press a button to do something in the program, well, it already has its memory ready to be used. It doesn't have to do any work for that. And similarly with I/O time, you know, if I'm not using the disk right now, I might as well use it to write some stuff back, since, you know, it's not going to cost me anything in effect. So after that, we talked about cases where this LRU model broke down. And there are two big cases we talked about. There's things that programs really do where least recently used is not actually a good policy. One of these was scanning through a large file where, well, this is exactly what we don't want for least recently used because the next part of the file we use, if we're scanning through it multiple times, is the part we access furthest ago of all the things in the file. Or reading a file exactly once, well, everything we just used in the file, we're not using again. But our least recently used policy is going to say, you better keep that in memory, we just used it. And that's not what we want. And we mentioned a policy that Linux used to deal with this, where they just said, okay, we want to usually do least recently used, but first we're going to confirm that it's not one of these patterns by trying to keep it as inactive until we see it referenced twice. So we're going to not assume the first use means it's going to be used again. We're going to say if something's really part of the working set, it's going to be referenced a couple times in quick succession. So we'll keep those things. We won't keep around things that are only referenced once. We'll assume it's probably one of these patterns until we confirm otherwise. And so that was what we talked about for all our paging stuff, and I understand that I went through it pretty quickly last time, probably more quickly than I should, which is why I'm being careful about reviewing it. So any questions on anything we talked about for page replacement from last time? Okay, so the topic we moved on to, and we just barely started last time, was about devices. So now that we know how we're managing all our data we sometimes store on disk, we want to talk about how do we talk to things like this in our operating system. And we learned about the high-level interface, that devices, you know, in the Unix model are represented as files. So we have these files, but they aren't like files on disk. They actually represent like a keyboard, and speakers, and so on. And mostly we can read and write for them, but sometimes that doesn't make sense, like ejecting a DVD that's not really writing to a DVD. So we'll have these extra operations where one way POSIX deals with that, it has this IOCTL call you can make on a file descriptor, which is for I/O control operations, which don't make sense as writes, like ejecting a DVD. And so we talked about the user interface when we finished up last time. And I'd like to talk about, well, what does it look like under the hood? So we have these files, and we have multiple different implementations of the files, depending on what type of device we're talking about. So I'll give an example of how Linux deals with it. So Linux has this struct, which is a struct of function pointers. So this is the syntax for a function pointer. So this here, read, is a pointer to a function returning s size t, which is basically a long, and taking a struct file, a char star, a size t, and an offset, which is basically a long. So that implements the read operation, and they have pointers for this for write, for IOCTL, for mmap, and so on. And the idea is that when you're writing the driver for a device, something which knows how to talk to a particular kind of device, you write all these operations, and you get past them for the files for your device, and you implement them to work with, you know, that speaker or whatever type of device you're implementing. And you make them do whatever you want it to do for that device. So there's one special case which doesn't have this interface in Linux and commonly among other Unix-like operating systems. And this is something known as block devices. So here we have a character device, as it's called, because our read and writes take char pointers and take a size, which is going to be in bytes. That is number of characters to read and write. But for some devices, this is not a great fit. One example is disks. So for disks, the actual interface of the hardware doesn't work in terms of bytes. It works in terms of these larger units. And also, we want to use the disk with the page cache, where we're not ever going to really care about reading individual bytes anyways. We're only going to read pages of data from the disk, because that's what we can store in our page cache. So there's this separate interface that Linux and most other Unixes have internally for devices which work in terms of blocks, as they call it. So they'll load and read a whole block of data. And that, in Linux, has this separate table of function pointers, which has this read or write a page of data at a time operation. So rather than, for my disk, implementing, let's read a single part of the disk, typically we'll do, let's read a whole page of data or write a whole page of data. And this makes sense because, well, we actually are only going to use this disk with the page cache anyways. So that's the real operation we need. When we want to do reads or writes of smaller things, we'll do it by reading or writing the page that contains all the data and then using the page cache to actually access the disk. To write to the page cache, read from the page cache after we use these operation, this read, write, page operation to fill the page cache or write back from the page cache. Okay. So questions? These interfaces? Okay. So we've seen what the interfaces that exist within the kernel, and by and large, the main ones mirror our system calls, and these are sort of just a level below. They mirror what the page cache wants to do for page replacement. So let's talk about how the device driver actually does the communication with the device. And so I have this sort of flow diagram of what's going to happen when we read or write from a device file. So first, we're going to have our I/O request come in. So it's going to be like a read or a write system call, or maybe we'll access something with a page fault. Either way, we get this I/O request from the program. And that's going to go to one of those routines I showed you function pointers for just now that is for a particular kind of device. And the first thing it's generally going to do is it's going to say, do I already have a copy of this data in buffers I'm managing? So the device drivers will generally have buffers. So like for keyboards, we'll have buffers of recent key presses I just read that I haven't given to a program yet. And we'll first check, can I just handle it from buffers? And if so, it's just going to say, okay, we can just return our result. We can return from the read system call right away. I don't need to do any work. I already talked to the device. I don't need to do it now. But sometimes, of course, it won't be there yet. I haven't pressed the key yet, so we actually need to communicate with the device. So in that case, we'll start the I/O operation if necessary. So for something like a disk, we probably need to tell the disk, hey, I want to read this part of the disk. For something like the keyboard, well, it's probably always working, so we just do the second step of putting the thread that made this request to sleep, because we can't satisfy that request yet. And later on, after the I/O operation is done, that thread will be woken up. We'll do the in-kernel equivalent of pthread con signal or con broadcast to wake up the thread, and it will store and return the result, like from read or loaded into the page cache, whatever we need, depending on the kind of I/O request we have. So this is known as what I'll call the top half of the device driver. So this is the part of the device driver, part of the implementation for a particular device, that runs in the thread that actually makes the I/O request. And I call it the top half to distinguish it from this other part, which I'll call the bottom half, which runs from the trap handler. So it's not actually part of the thread that made the read or write call. It's run because an interrupt happens from the device, or some timer expires, something like that, but not as part of the thread which is actually making the read or write call. So typically here, we get an interrupt saying, like, hey, I have a key press for you, and there's a part of the device driver which runs immediately there. And what it's going to do is it's going to say, okay, I have some data from the device. So if I have a key press, I'm going to load that key press into a buffer for later. And I'm going to figure out, hey, was there anyone waiting on this key press? And if so, I'm going to wake them up. And in some cases, I might trigger more I/O operations. So for example, let's say I'm using a disk, and I ask to read something, and the disk could only read one thing at a time, then I'm going to read the next thing that I need to read in that case. So we update the buffers, and this might wake up our waiting thread. So later on, when it gets scheduled by the scheduler, which might not be right away, that's fine, it will read the result from the buffer and return it. Okay. So questions on what this looks like? Okay. So this is our device driver flow. And so I'll work through what exactly happens in all these parts for XV6 talking to the console, which is probably, the main device we've been using and basically the only one XV6 has. So XV6, like Linux, has a notion of device files which have tables of operations for their particular kind of device. And the way XV6 stores all of these is it just has an array of all the possible kinds of device files. And each one of these has a read operation and a write operation. We saw in Linux, we have a few more things we want to do. XV6 is really simple, so we only have read or write that we care about. And we have this array of possible types of devices, and we need to figure out what's the index into the array. And the way XV6 and Unix handles this in general is we have a file on disk, which is a special kind of file. It's marked as, this is not a normal file, this is a device, and it just contains that number. It contains the index into the array, and this is also the scheme that real Unix and Linux use. They just have two numbers instead of one, but the idea is the device file contains, here's the number of the device driver we're using. So in XV6, they have arbitrarily decided that the console is index 1, And they make a special file on the disk, which just says, this is not a regular file. This is represents a device, and it contains the number 1, so we know to look up index 1 in this array whenever someone opens that file. Yeah?
If you had like two consoles, you have two files that both have 1?
So the question is, what would we do if we had two devices of the same type, like two consoles? Would you have two files that have 1, or would you have do something else? So most likely you'd want to have different indexes for each one. That's a common approach. But like it doesn't make sense to like not have them related. This is one reason why I mentioned on the slide, we didn't talk about Unix and Linux have a major and a minor number. So what they'll commonly do is they'll say major number 1 is consoles, and which console of all the ones you have connected is the minor number. That's the most common way of dealing with it. But another thing you could do is you could look at this inode, which represents the file you're talking about, and you could use information from that to determine what to do in your device driver, which would be a less common strategy. Because your device driver, well, it has access to information like what was the file name if it wants it, if it digs deep enough. But yeah, but the most common way is you'll have separate numbers, which means you often have this sort of hierarchical numbering scheme. So you can have all the consoles each have a unique number. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So as this code snippet shows, XV6 sets these two function pointers for the console at boot. So there's a console write read function and a console write function. And these implement the read or write system call for the console. And the console is typically what you're printing out to or reading from in an XV6 user program. So these are implementing, well, this part of the flow. So after we get a read or write system call, it calls those function pointers, either the read or the write one, and then they do these operations and eventually return a result. So here's what the top half of the console looks like, the read part looks like. So this is an excerpt of the console read function. And the first thing it does is it says, okay, while we have characters to read, let's see if we're at the end of the buffer. And it's doing this, this is like a little funny, R equals W. R is a pointer to where we're reading from, W is a pointer to where we're writing to in the buffer. So it's just saying R is the buffer that doesn't have no data in it right now. And while that happens, it puts the thread to sleep. So this is the check if we already have the data, if we don't put the thread to sleep logic in the console device driver. And you notice it has a while loop, which might be very familiar to you if you remember how we dealt with pthreadcon wait. It's basically the same pattern we're using here, but inside the XV6 kernel. Okay. And then after we check if it's satisfied and possibly put the thread to sleep, we need to get the result. So there's some code after we check that there's data, which says, while we have more characters, copy. This is the Stardust, is the destination the user supplied. Copy to the user, argument to write, the actual data we read, until we get to new line or we run out of characters, and then return how much we actually read. So this is implementing copying the result from the buffer into the user buffer, what the user passed to read in returning the result. And note that we're incrementing our read location here, so we keep track of what part of the buffer we've used. So if we have another call to read, we're not going to read this again. Okay. So this is what our console top half is doing. We wait for the buffer to fill. We have this sleep call, which acts very much like pthreadcon wait, to wait for the buffer to fill. Then we copy from that buffer into the user's buffer, because the device has its own buffer in the kernel that it writes things into until it goes to the user buffer. We check if we're done, and if not, we keep going. We repeat. Okay, so questions about what you saw here for reading from the console? Okay, so this is the part which runs in the thread that calls read, but there's also a part which has to fill that buffer, and that's not anywhere in this console read code. It doesn't fill that buffer, it just copies from it. So there's something which gets an interrupt from the device and actually decides to copy from the device. So to get an interrupt, this all goes to the trap function, which you hopefully have written some code in for the paging checkpoint, so you might know something about it. And there's some code here for dealing with key presses. So we see what type of trap, what type of exception do we have? And this number TIRQ0 plus IRQ keyboard is the keyboard device exception, device interrupt, that some activity happened on the keyboard that we need to deal with. So we call this function KBD enter, and that's where the actual code which knows how to talk to the keyboard and figure out, hey keyboard, what was happening that made you give me an interrupt? And we have the second function that you see called a lot, which is a way of telling the CPU, hey, I'm done with this interrupt, I don't want it again. If you don't do that, the CPU is going to assume you aren't done with the interrupt, you want me to keep giving it to you until you've told me that you're done with it. Okay. So we have this keyboard interrupt handler, and that's going to need to do this work we see here. It's going to need to fill the buffer and wake up that waiting thread. And possibly, not for the keyboard, but for some other devices, we might say, oh, I have some request I couldn't send earlier because the device didn't have enough memory to handle it yet. So the keyboard interrupt function actually does this. I will talk about the code in a bit, but we need to talk about, well, it actually reads from the device. How do we do that? How do we talk to a device? Like, what's the way that works? And to talk about that, we need to think about, well, how is the device actually connected to the processor? So the simplest way to think about connecting the device to the processor is we already talked about having this memory bus where our processors are connected to each other and our processors are connected to memory. Well, we can just put something else on there, which we'll call a device controller. So it will just be on the memory device, and it will know how to talk to the external hardware, like on a keyboard. And it's going to have a few control registers in it, indicating, for example, do I have a key press? Am I reading or writing? If it's like a disk or something like that. And it will also have like buffers and queues of like data that, the key press I just got that you haven't read yet. And we'll have all these things in this device controller. And the question is, well, how does the OS get to them? Well, since it's on the memory bus, we can pretend to be memory. And we're just going to say, we're going to assign a memory address to all these control registers and to the buffers on the device controller. And because it's on the memory bus, it's going to say, oh, you're trying to write to address 80004800. That's me. I'm going to take care of that just like I were memory. But I'm not actually going to update like DRAM. I'm going to update my control register and do something based on that. And these control registers, I call them control registers because that's the generic term, but they might not act like normal registers. So you're used to like registers to store a value. These control registers might do something special when you add access them. So for example, maybe writing to the read control register starts a read. And that's something we can do because we control the hardware that implements this, the device designer controls the hardware, implements the controller. It doesn't have to have it act like a register. It can just say, it's a read, write to this address, therefore trigger the actual device to do something. So it can decide on some interface based on reading and writing these special memory locations that interacts with the device. And similarly, we might have some buffers and queues. A good example where we'd have like lots of buffers and queues is something like a network interface card. Like we have stuff that we just got in over, say, our Wi-Fi card. We want to store it temporarily until the OS gets it. But these, similarly, can just have memory addresses that the OS can copy from. And our device controller just says, oh, you're trying to read from that physical memory address. I'll give you this part of my buffer. Okay. So there's another thing we need here to like actually make this work, which you've already seen. We saw that like when I press a key, I have this interrupt happen, and we need a way for that to happen. So typically, in addition to being connected to the memory bus like memory is, these devices will also be connected to what we'll call an interrupt controller, which is how they'll signal the CPU, hey, do an interrupt for me now. And this will be something the OS sets up on boot to figure out what interrupt number do I want for this device and so on. That's sort of at least a conceptually separate connection to the processor. Okay, so I've given you sort of this model of how we connect our devices. And the way I like thinking about it is that with our device controller, basically our devices appear as sort of magical memory. That it looks like memory, but instead of, you know, actually acting like memory, you read from it and you get your key presses. But you just read from it like memory, but you're getting this special feature, or you write to it and it writes to the disk, or it reads from the disk. But the interface is the same as the instructions for accessing memory. So I've shown you this model where we have our device controller directly on the memory bus. Sometimes that isn't actually what we do. There's more indirection. So a common thing that real processors will have is we'll have what we'll call a bus adapter, and our devices will be connected via something which has a different interface than our memory bus. So a classic example of this is like USB. USB stands for Universal Serial Bus. It's not the way our memory buses work. So we have an adapter which has its own device controller which knows how to talk to these other device controllers over this completely different interface. And expose these control registers to our processor in a less direct way. So commonly there will be more indirection. We won't talk about the details of how this works, but I'd like you to know that no, we don't actually typically connect our keyboard directly to the memory bus via like one level of indirection. Usually there's more things in between because our keyboard is not actually using that interface. So we have this magic memory model. So for our keyboard controller, this is sort of ways things might work. We have some special memory location where you read and you get the last key press or release. You just get the information, what was the last key press or release that happened? And because the device controller isn't real memory, it can do something weird here. It can say, when you read from that location, we'll clear the buffer for you. Mark it as you already got that key press. And it can do that because, well, it's not, you know, real memory. It can detect your read and do something in response to it in addition to giving you a value. And also, it handles giving interrupts. So there are other interfaces we might imagine, just to give some examples. So for a display controller, the simplest interface is we have these memory locations, which just represent pixels on the screen. You write to memory locations, and it shows up on the screen. And the device controller can implement that. And you're actually writing to like a little buffer on the device, which it copies to the screen via the output the monitor expects. Or a network interface, you write what you want to send over the network to a buffer on the device controller, and then you write a special send now signal to a special memory location, and it copies that buffer to the Wi-Fi card or to the Ethernet port. And later on, you read from a status location to figure out what happened. Was it sent successfully? Wasn't it not sent successfully? To figure out what was going on. Okay, so questions about any of these sort of models for interacting with devices? Okay. So there's one thing that this magic memory model has a problem with. Let's think about caching. So I have this special last key press memory location. So I press H, the OS reads H, and it's a memory location. My processor has a cache. What should happen here? So I read H. So there was an H in that memory location, which you don't cache it, you say? Yeah, so we want to not cache it, because I want to not read H over and over again. I want to read the next thing that was sent by the keyboard. But if I do nothing, if it just looks like a memory location, well, my processor is going to say, hey, I just read an H there. Of course there's an H there. Why should I go to the memory bus to figure that out? I already know. So our solution here is that we're going to have support for the OS marking memory as uncacheable. And in x86, one of the bits in the page table, in addition to like the writable bit and the access bit and so on, you can say things accessed using this page table entry don't use the cache. So this is something the OS will do when it sets itself up to access the device's memory. It will create a page table entry to access it, which will have the physical address the device is using, and it will also be marked as uncacheable, so it doesn't have to worry about this problem. So I've talked about devices as magic memory locations, and this is the simplest way to think about how device controllers work. And you'd think that this is how x86 would work, but of course x86 just doesn't do the simplest thing. So x86 has something called an I/O address. So basically x86 just has a separate set of addresses for I/O devices, which are used for some, but not all I/O devices. So some I/O devices use magic memory addresses, just like I discussed. Some use this separate set of addresses, which are called I/O addresses. And this is because historically there was a separate I/O bus. This is typically not true anymore, or not as true. And you can just imagine having I/O addresses just means like you have a 65th bit on your memory bus, in addition on your addresses, which is one if it's an I/O address, zero otherwise. So it works the same way, it's just a separate set of addresses for historical reasons. More recent processors have typically not been designed with this separate set of addresses because it's not really useful. You don't really need it. So I'm mentioning this because now we're going to look at the code in XV6 that actually communicates with the keyboard. And this is what it looks like. So we have this inb function, and this wraps an instruction called in, which is basically a move from an I/O address to a register. So that's a move from the address, which is in this constant, which is I/O address 64. So it's reading from address 64 in I/O space to get the status. And if the status has this bit set, which indicates data and buffer, that's what DIB stands for, then it reads from this data buffer address, address 60 hex on the I/O, and which returns the data and clears the buffer, marks it as not having data in it anymore. And this is the code in the keyboard interrupt handler in XV6. And then it takes that data, copies it to the buffer, and waits for the next keyboard interrupt. Question?
Yeah, so if there isn't data in buffer, this particular method is just going to return. So then do we handle that like saving and retrying in some higher level method?
So the question is, if there isn't data in the buffer, this method returns. So the assumption there is that we did something like maybe we read multiple characters in one interrupt and we got an extra interrupt that wasn't useful, so we just want to stop processing data. Or we got a spurious interrupt for some reason, and we want to still do something correct. We don't want to assume just because we got an interrupt that means there's definitely something there if the device tells us, nope, no data. Okay, other questions? Okay. So this is sort of the basic way we can do talk to devices. And what I've been talking to you is a way of talking to devices known as programmed I/O. Because what you saw here is we had our data buffer and we read from it directly. And for keyboards, this absolutely makes sense. But when we're speaking about a device with more data, like a network card, it makes a little less sense because the OS is going to need to run this loop where it reads each byte of, or each, you know, 64 bits or whatever size we can read from the device controller. Probably still triggered by an interrupt and so on, but you know, that loop is actually pretty expensive. And we can do better than that. So there's this thing which is better than what we call programmed I/O, where the OS copies everything by itself, called direct memory access. And this is based on the observation that, well, we have this device controller, which is on the memory bus. It can just say, oh, I'm on the memory bus. I can talk to memory myself. Why do I need to bother having the OS copy from me to the buffer by going from my the device controller to the processor and then back out to memory, which is effectively what we're saying to do. So the way this works is that one of our control registers will be an address of a buffer to use, and that will replace having a buffer on the actual device controller. So rather than actually having like a buffer for data that was received from the network, we'll just ask the OS to tell us, where do you want it? Where is your buffer for this data? And the OS is going to write to this control register saying, hey, I want you to write that data to physical address 9000 hex. And then when this device, say, gets information from the network, it will write to that memory location instead of writing to an internal buffer. Then later on, the OS can read from that rather than copying. Or if the OS is really, really clever, it could maybe have set that address up to be exactly where it wants the data anyways. Like it could be the page in the page cache where it's loading the data to. And therefore avoid a copy. So this is known as direct memory access. So what we're avoiding here is we're avoiding having the processor copy from the device controller to where it actually wants the data, hopefully. And for something like disk or network I/O, where we have a lot of data, this should save a lot of time because we're not writing this loop where we're just copying stuff. We're just having the device do it. We're having the device do it while the OS is running other stuff. So my program is using the CPU a bunch. Sure, there's something copying to memory, but it probably doesn't affect my program's performance very much. It also means that the device has a huge buffer space. We don't have to, like, if you want to have like hundreds of megabytes of buffered packets, you can do that because you're just using memory. Whereas if we were talking about doing that with programmed I/O, that means our device controller to support that would need to have several hundred megabytes of RAM on it, which would be very expensive. We probably wouldn't do that. And if the OS is clever, it could maybe put the data directly where it wants it in the end. If it's really clever, maybe it could figure out to put it like where the user's read call is. It's actually very hard to do, but when you can do it, it's going to be a lot faster. Okay, so yes.
Is it possible for you to like boost your keypress if like the bus is being used by like another thing?
So the question is it possible to lose a keypress if the bus is used by another thing? So we haven't talked about how memory buses work, but they're going to have some mechanism to make sure that they handle conflicts in a way which doesn't lose data. And there's multiple choices for that, and I don't actually know what any of them are, which is why I didn't talk about the details of that. Other questions? Okay, so I've talked about this device is accessing memory. And one aside on that is I showed here that we're getting a physical address that the devices talk with. And this is actually not super convenient because it means that we need to assign physical address to devices even though we're usually working with virtual addresses. And it also means that things are real awkward if we want the device to write multiple pages of data. We have to have a contiguous set of physical pages for the device, which is annoying. And also it means, notably, that if the device messes up, it can overwrite arbitrary memory, which is kind of annoying. So if our device controller is broken, suddenly it breaks our entire system by just scribbling over our memory, because it can do that. So to address this, recent systems sometimes have an I/O management unit, which is basically page tables but for devices. So you can set page tables for the devices, so you can have non-contiguous buffers that the devices think are contiguous, and you can make it so the device can't just write to random memory addresses and mess up your system if it's broken. And also, as I mentioned, this is helpful for virtual machines. So if you have this, you can safely let the virtual machine send things to the device and not worry that it's going to use that to write to memory it's not supposed to. Okay. And you would think that these would be commonly used, but not really, even though they're kind of pretty common these days. But OSs use them a lot less often than they're supported. Okay, so that's about devices. So any questions about how devices work? Yeah?
This was like a while back, but can you go over again what you mean by that like special file on device that has like the device number and how exactly that works?
Okay, so we talked about having files named like this, like these were examples. So in the file system, there's going to be, this file is actually going to contain, basically it says, it's marked as device file major number, something, minor number something, and this is the information that is going to be stored on disk. Or in the file system if it's not on disk. So the file system is going to contain, this is a device, not a normal file, and it's going to contain a major number and a minor number, and there's going to be a table which is going to say, which has major number, minor number, and pointer to functions. So which will have an entry for every single device. And the table, maybe we store all the major, maybe all everything with the same major number uses the same pointers or functions or not, but there's some table like that. And this is how we manage when we shut down the system, we can store this device file with those two numbers. So, and this means that it's okay if like we upgrade our OS and the function pointers change, we're not storing them, so that's not a problem. We're storing this major and minor number, which we'll keep consistent. Yeah?
Does the top half ever access magic memory, or is that only bottom?
So the question is, does the top half of the device controller ever access magic memory? And the answer is yes, sometimes. And this might be because it's possible that this sender QIO operation would talk to the device directly. So that might require accessing memory. It depends on how the device works. So for a keyboard, there's no like operation like that. For other devices, it might make sense to do, or you might have to wait for an interrupt to say the device is ready to take a request, depending on how the device controller works. Other questions? I'll go back to my summary slide. So that's how devices work. And now that we know how we can talk to devices, we're going to talk about our next big topic, which is file systems. That we know we have files stored on disk, and we know how we like read parts of the disk into memory and keep them cached. But we haven't actually talked about, given a file name, how do we figure out where that is? How do we decide where to write it if we're writing a new file? And these are the sorts of things we're going to talk about. So we're going to talk about file systems. And to talk about file systems, I'm going to first talk about hard drive interfaces. And by hard drive, I mean hard drive and solid state disks. And the interfaces work in a particular way, which is going to dramatically affect how file systems work. So file systems are designed with these interfaces in mind. And the hardware interface, you know, what we can do with that magic memory for hard drives and solid state disks, works in this unit we call sectors. Historically, this was 512 bytes. These days, it might be a bit bigger, maybe 4 kilobytes or so. But the operations we can do are read whole sectors and write whole sectors. So the commands we can give are read sector I to J or write sector I to J this data. And for reasons we'll talk about later, we typically want to read or write more than a sector at a time, much more than a sector, because that will be faster. So this is the unit we're going to work with, and this means that we're not going to do some of the things you might do in 2150. Like, we can't actually write like a single pointer, for example. So just doing like a hash table with buckets, not going to make sense with this interface, because we can't write one 8-byte pointer. You have to write a whole 512 bytes. And that will come up later. So this is what we have to work with. And what we want to get is we want to get this sort of hierarchy of files and directories on disk that you're hopefully familiar with from having used machines with directories for a while. And we have to answer a bunch of problems. So one problem we have to answer is, given a file, where do we find its data? And as I mentioned, we're reading in sectors, so what sectors is the file's data in? So we need to have some lookup table where we can take a file, probably by name, and look up what sectors that has its data. Given a directory, we want to be able to list that directory. So we need to be able to say, given a directory, where is the list of files that are in it? What is that list? We also need to have the metadata. So like if you used a shared machine, you know files have owners, so owned by a particular user. You have modification dates, you have permission bits, you have size. You have all this extra information about files, which isn't actually the data of the files, but is still something we want to know where to look up. So we need to decide, where do we store that? How is that stored? We also need to make decisions about what happens when the user tries to create new files or update files. So if we make a new file, where do we put that? Where does that go? How do we find free space? We make a file or directory bigger, well, where do we allocate the new data for the parts of the file directory that don't fit in what we had before? These are all questions that will have very different answers depending on our file system design. So I'm going to start by talking about the FAT file system design. I'm talking about it now partly because we have an assignment on it after the current assignment, and partly because it is a really, really simple file system. So really simple means, well, it's not hard to implement. But it also means that you'll when you think about some of these choices, we'll find out that they're not very efficient choices. But it has simple answers which work for all these questions that just maybe aren't the most efficient answers, and we'll talk about more efficient answers after we talk about how FAT works. So the FAT file system, it's so named for its primary data structure, which is called the file allocation table. And this is a widely used file system, partly because it's simple. So like, for example, if you get an SD card, it's probably formatted with this file system, or a version of it. So FAT has this file allocation table. We'll talk about what that is later. First, we'll talk about how does FAT divide the disk up into pieces. In fact, like many file systems, it's going to divide the disk up into a fixed size unit. FAT calls them clusters. Some other file systems call these, other file systems call these blocks for basically the same idea. And the cluster is going to be one or more sectors. So the sector is fixed by the disk. The disk has a particular size it can read or write at a time. Clusters are going to be some multiple of that size. The notion being that just because the disk writes or reads 512 bytes at a time doesn't mean we ever want to do that. We want a bigger unit. So FAT chooses a size usually between 5 and 12 and 4,096 bytes when you create a disk. Yes?
So is the cluster size constant across one machine, or can you have one system that has a cluster 512 and a cluster 4096, or is it?
So the question is the cluster size per machine, or what decides it? So this is going to be, as we'll see later, this is determined per disk. So when we set up a disk, when we do what's known as formatting a disk, we'll decide on the cluster size. And if you have multiple disks, they might all have different cluster sizes. And this is how we'll divide up data on the disk. So when we figure out where a file data is stored, we're going to get a list of clusters where that data is. So we need some data structure which can store a list of these cluster numbers. We'll number them, say, starting with 0, and figure out where that is. And this data structure is going to be the file allocation table. So it's going to contain exactly this information, and it's going to contain it in a particular format. So it's going to be an array with one entry per cluster. And each entry contains a number, and that number usually represents the next cluster after this one. So this means that for reading a file, what we're going to do is we're going to figure out where its first cluster is. I'll talk about how we figure that out later. Let's assume we're given the file starts at cluster 10. I know that's where the first part of the file's data is. Then we're going to say, okay, it starts at cluster 10, then the next cluster is cluster 14, so that goes to here. After cluster 14, the next cluster is 15, after 15, it's 13. And it's just a linked list stored in this array. So each array element just points to the next thing, and we have a special value for the end, our equivalent of null, and I'm representing it as -1 in this example. For the assignment, you should read the specification, which tells you exactly what value is used for that. Yes?
Do you separate ranges of cluster numbers represent different files? For example, why are you starting at 10 in this case for the cluster number?
So the question is, why are we starting at 10? So somewhere, there's information saying, foo.txt is at 10. I'm going to talk later about where that would be. But yes, we have some information that tells us where to start, and all the clusters I skipped over presumably are parts of other files. Yes?
Does this mean the smallest size a file could be is 512?
So the question is, does this mean the smallest size a file could be is 512, or one cluster? Yeah. So the file, if we have 512-byte clusters, we have to use at least 512 bytes for the file. And we have 4K clusters, which isn't uncommon. We'll have to use at least 4 kilobytes for a file, even if it doesn't have 4 kilobytes of data. Yes?
Never mind. So then their pointer would just go to -1 right away?
The question is, in the case where the file only takes up one cluster, its pointer would go to -1 right away? Yes. It would have the end mark right away. There's no next cluster after we start. Other questions? Yeah.
Is there a way of
Question, is there a way of marking if a cluster doesn't have valid data in it? Yes, and we'll talk about that later. And we'll just use a particular number for that. So we need to actually store this on disk. So the way we'll do that is FAT will just say there's a particular part of the disk. We'll talk about exactly how we determine where that is, where we're going to store this just this big array. And if you want to read from that array, you need to read that part of the disk, load it into memory, figure out where the entries are. And if you want to write it, you need to read it into memory, change the things you want to change, write it back out. And this, you know, represents our files. So if we think about the file we just looked at earlier, this array represents the pointers of the different parts of the file. So as I showed earlier, we have the first part of the file, and the second, third, and fourth stored in those locations on the disk, as indicated by this big array. So we read this array, then we use that to figure out where to read the file. So our reading procedure is given the file, given its start location, we read the first cluster, we read the file allocation table to figure out where the next cluster is, we read the next cluster, we read the file allocation table to figure out where the next cluster after that is, and so on, until we see the end of file number in the file allocation table. So questions on this procedure? Straightforward enough, I hope. Just a loop or a recursive function, your choice. So that's given that we have a start location, but we really want a file name. We don't commonly say, hey, I want to compile file 17. That's not a thing you would be happy about. We want a file name. I want to compile foo.c. So the way this works is we're going to have directories which tell us what the names of files are. And in fact, directories are just files, but their data, rather than being, you know, normal data like text, is a list of the name of a file, its starting location, along with any other data about the file, like some notable data is the size of the file. So this is how we know if I have a 10-byte file, this is how I know it's 10 bytes, even if I have a whole cluster allocated to store it. So we'll have a directory. In this case, I'm saying we have a directory that starts at cluster 9. And it just has a list of entries, what we'll call directory entries, each one of which contains a file name, its start location, and its size, and possibly other information. We'll see exactly what other information later. And given this, we'll say, OK, it starts at cluster 10. So we'll say there's a file starting at cluster 10 because it says index.html is there. So if you want to read index.html, we'll read this directory. We'll see this is index.html. We'll start at cluster 10. We'll look through the FAT, and then we'll say each of these is part of the file, and that's where the file's data is if we want to read index.html. And because we have the size of the file in the directory, that's going to tell us maybe we don't actually use all of the data in all the clusters. So the last cluster will have some data we won't actually care about. Okay, so questions about this? Okay, so I've given you sort of a high-level view of what a directory entry might look like. FAT's directory entries are a little less clean. So here is what the format of a FAT directory entry. And for the assignment, we have a specification which like tells you all the details. I'm going to go through high level. So we have a file name and extension for which we have exactly 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 characters for the name and 3 for the extension. You might say, what do we do if we want to store a different type of file name? Well, for the assignment, you don't need to implement that. In real FAT, what happened is they started out saying, I only care about DOS. DOS uses 8 character file names and 3 character extensions, and that's it. And then they realized, you know, maybe that's a little inconvenient. So they have this thing which is added on top of this where you have directory entries in a different format than this, where you tell that there are those directory entries by looking at this attributes value. You're not going to have to implement that, but that's what they do, is they have extra directory entries for the longer file names. Okay, so but this is for readme.txt, which helpfully doesn't need that longer file name because it fits in those 8 characters. So we have our file name and extension, and we have other information. So one piece of information is we need the cluster number, and that's stored in 2 pieces. So we have the high bits and the low bits of the cluster number. And this is all little endian. So we have the high bits in little endian and the low bits in little endian of the cluster number. So we put that together to get the starting cluster number. You might ask, why is this in 2 pieces? Doesn't that seem inconvenient? This is another historical thing. When they designed FAT, they said, well, disks aren't that big. So they just said, we only need 16 bits for our cluster number. And then they realized, you know, maybe that doesn't work so well. So they added a few extra bits. So we have our file name, our 8 character file name, and a 3 character extension. And as I said, longer file names, we're going to encode them using extra directory entries, which will have the attribute value set to help find those. And it's not something we'll have you implement for the homework, unless you really want to. It's not especially interesting in my opinion. We have this attributes value, and this is where we store information about kinds of files. So this is it a directory versus a regular file? We tell by the directory, by this attributes field, it's not going to be 0 in the case where it's a directory. Is it read-only? And a bunch of other things. And this is sort of general file type information. It's 1 byte, and it's basically each bit means something is how it works. So there's something else we need to do here. So one thing is that, well, when I start creating a directory, I'm going to have at least a cluster full of directory entries. I need to know how many of those are actually real directory entries. So FAT has a convention that we use the first character of the file name to mark this. We could have used the attributes field, but we don't. And if it's 0, a null, that means it's the end of the directory. So that's how you know when I create a new directory, it doesn't have any files in it. That's how I know when I read it, there's no files in it. I can stop. I don't have to read the whole cluster and all this unused data. And if it contains this special value hex E5, that means it's unused. That means there's still more entries in this directory, but this one we're not using. How might that happen? So one way is if I create a file, I have a directory entry for it, I want to remove the file. Using this, I can just mark the file with this unused character rather than shifting all the other directory entries around. Okay. So there's some other things we see here. So we have our creation date, our last access date, and our last modification time, along with the file size. So there's some other things that FAT decides to store in the directory entries. And as a brief aside, you might say, wait, what is this access time date? What format is that in? FAT has a very strange choice of format that is not anything you would ever guess. That it's this sort of uses certain bits for each sub bits of the field to represent seconds, minutes, hours, and so on. So, I showed you the directory entry pictorially, but you know, you want to actually do this from, say, a C program, and you could say, okay, so the the last access time, that's going to be by 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. So to access that, I'm going to write dir entry of 17 time plus dir entry of 18. You know, I could do it that way. I could like have an array of bytes and access it that way. That's really inconvenient. So what typically you'll see done in file system implementations is we'll create a C struct that we've carefully designed to have the exact right layout in memory. So you can just copy bytes into this struct and it will just work. To make that happen, we have to mark it for the compiler as please don't add extra stuff to this. And that's what this attribute pack does for GCC or claim. It says, hey, compiler, really don't add extra stuff to this. I mean it. I don't care if you think it's inefficient. I don't want any extra padding to make like my memory accesses faster by not going over the cache line, cache blocks or something like that. And notice that we use these types, which have a known fixed size. So uint 8t, 8-byte unsigned integer, 16-byte unsigned integer, and so on, because we have exact sizes we want. And in this case, everything's a little endian. And for the assignment, you're implementing a little endian, so you don't have to worry about byte order either. In real file systems, sometimes you do have to worry about byte order. But that's still easier with something like this, because you just, when you read a field, you swap its bytes. And you might say, gosh, you have these horrible names in this data structure. Why did you do that? I'm trying to match the documentation Microsoft provides for this, the FAT format. Not because I think you should use names like this. So that's what directories are. So what we're used to is like we have a path which references a particular directory. So we're going to say foo bar baz file.txt. So to handle this, we're going to read what's known as the root directory to find foo. So we're going to find an entry with the name foo. Hopefully it's marked as a directory. If it's not, we say, sorry, you tried to access something that doesn't make sense. Then we read foo's directory entries to find bar. We read bar's directory's entries to find baz. We read baz's directory entries to find file.txt. And this is the procedure. And in practice, hopefully, we use the page cache for this, so it's not as horribly slow as it might sound with respect to how many times we're reading from the disk. Okay. There's one unanswered thing here, which is we need to find the root directory. So where is the root directory? And our answer for that is that we're just going to store it at a well-known location. We're going to just choose a fixed location for the root directory. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to write some data near the beginning of the disk indicating things like how big are clusters and where is the root directory. So I have how big are clusters with bytes per sector, sectors per cluster. So I know how big my clusters are. And I'm going to indicate here, for example, how many sectors do I have until I get to the file allocation table. Because I need to find that to read the root directory. And I'm also going to indicate how big is the file allocation table and where is the root directory. So this is all going to be stored in this information at the beginning of the disk. We know it's always at the beginning of the disk. We don't need to look for it. So when we get or give it a disk, we read this first, we figure out how big our cluster is, where is our root directory, and that's how we actually handle a new disk and find everything, you know, from the beginning. Questions on this format? Yes. In that 4 through 9 range. So whoever made it set up the disk wants to put there. There's one thing that's mentioned on this slide, which is that there's actually usually two copies of the file allocation table, just in case the first one gets damaged. That's one thing you might put there. Yeah?
How does the OS know what kind of file system it is? Like, do all file systems have the same header?
The question is, how does the OS know what kind of file system it is? So hopefully the header has some bytes which are unique to the kind of file system, so the OS can detect automatically. Otherwise, you might have to tell it. Or another strategy is sometimes there will be information about having, you can have multiple file systems on one disk, and that there's some standard formats of tables for that, and that table might have the information about the kinds of those file systems. Yeah. The question is, does this imply if we create a new file, it needs to take up at least one cluster? Yes. And you've discovered one of the things that might annoy you about this file system design that we may do better then. Okay. And that's all I have, unless I can take questions now, but I think I'm out of time.